welcome to Rhymes Against Humanity. I am Adam Brodsky, the host master, such as it is, of Rhymes Against Humanity. And I am here on, we're recording in the downstairs today, because the downstairs is finally clean enough and spacious enough to record. So we have moved out of Studio B, which is essentially also the guest room, because I would have had to make the bed. So essentially I did a cost-benefit analysis, and I brought the microphone downstairs. So we slept the entire studio, which consists of this microphone, downstairs. And so we are recording. We are recording downstairs here, and I am happy to have. It is Martin Luther King's birthday, or the celebrated day of. So you're supposed to have a day of service, and this I checked with their parole officers, and Mike Brenner and Hoagie Wing. This both qualifies. I signed their little papers, and it counts as community service. Them doing that. So I'm happy to be with Mike Brenner and Hoagie Wing. Mike Slow-Mo Brenner, we're going to talk all about that, and we're going to spend a lot of time. We're going to get a little bit of the history, and then we're going to talk about this Chaturangi. Did I get it?
Chaturangi.
Okay, Chaturangi, which is, I'll show you some pictures that'll be on the webpage with this thing, but essentially it is Indian slide guitar, right? Okay, but instead you could say Chaturangi, which is sounds like that yoga move. So anyway, we will get right to it. Welcome, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming. You're still living in Fishtown, right?
I am.
Okay, you moved from one place to another?
Yeah, but still in the area.
Okay. Was it an upgrade? What'd you move?
It was a big upgrade. We were in a little Trinity.
Yeah.
For almost 10 years, including the first 6 years of my daughter's life. And by the time that she got to six and was, you know, flying down the spiral staircase.
You had a real spiral staircase and everything.
Well, you know, one of those ones that kind of...
Oh, you can only buy so big a TV, because
yeah,
how are you going to...
Exactly. So it was a very tiny place, but... and now we're in a bigger joint on the Kensington side of Frankfurt Ave.
Ooh, you're an urban pioneer now.
Yes.
Good for you.
We went from less than 1,000 square feet to like... 2,700 square feet.
Nice. Yeah. Do you have your own studio room in there?
I do.
Good for you, man. That's the dream. You too. Hoagie lives out in Broomall in the suburbs.
Yes.
Yeah. Like in a house, like a grown-up.
That's for real.
That's amazing.
Is awesome. A yard.
Yeah, I've been there. It's very cool. So you were, like, you were a Fishtown early adopter. You were here before I was. I moved in 06, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think of when... Well, Ruby was born in... like in 06, and we had been there for 4 years, so I guess I'd been there since 01 or 02.
Nice. That's for shizzle, because I remember one of my Steph and Susan took me to a party once, probably in like 97 or 98, and it was in the Northern Liberties, and I was it was real sketchy. I was like, wait, is it okay to park my car here? And now, you know, I couldn't even afford a parking spot down there.
I know. When I lived in Northern Liberties, there was no one there, and you could literally kind of park your car in the middle of the street and come back later. And now, of course, there's no parking. So,
But I do love the neighborhood. I enjoy the fish a lot.
I like Fishtown, yeah.
Good. All right, so let's get... Where'd you grow up?
Center City.
Okay, so you're the real deal.
Yeah, well, whatever that means.
But you're not like a suburban poser. I moved to town in 97.
No, I grew up in the Fittler Square area.
Okay.
Which was sort of... Very nice then. Now it's quite posh. But,
yeah,
it was nice area to grow up. I like Center City.
And we were talking before the mics went on. You used to go Society Hill Synagogue. That was your shul. And where's that? That's like Fifth and Pine.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a little row house with a Jewish star on top there.
No, that's the real old one. That's,
oh,
I forgot. That's like the oldest one in the city.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I can't remember what that's called. No, I guess mine is a Fifth and Spruce, and it's like the big white thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. The big white thing.
You know.
So now I first became aware of you, of Mike. I mean, we first met. You were, the Low Road was a big fucking deal.
Locally. We had a nice run.
Yeah, you guys were on WXPN all the time, and... were there two records, The Devil's Pocket, and was there another?
Yeah, there was two on Caroline Records.
Okay.
And then we did a sort of retrospective on Record Seller, but the first two came out on Caroline.
Okay.
Toured a lot and stuff like that.
And then, like around that time, so how did that band break up?
Well, I think we really just sort of... we pushed real hard to get on a label. We pushed real hard to tour, which we did. And we did get two records out on the label, and then they had a big shakeup, and like, you know, a million bands got dropped, including us.
Now, were they an imprint of a major, Caroline?
No, Caroline was like a big indie.
Okay.
And, you know, a couple of their bigger bands at the time were, like Smashing Pumpkins was originally on Caroline.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that, okay.
And we were signed to an imprint of Caroline called Passenger, which only signed two bands, and it was The Low Road and Ben Folds 5.
Oh, wow. How'd it work out for those Ben Folds kids?
they did pretty well. Yeah. But they moved to, actually, I think before their first Caroline record came out, they were already kind of on Sony at that point.
Oh, okay. I saw them a million years ago at the Khyber.
Oh, cool.
And I saw them schlep his piano in, and he had a tuner come and tune his piano. Behold, yeah, and I was just in awe that they brought, that he would bring a baby grand to shitty little clubs every night.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And we were at one club on tour with them, and the club said, you know, I don't think we're going to get this through the door. And even if we get it through the door, I don't think we're going to get on stage. And the three guys in Ben Folds 5 just said, okay, well, we're going to pack up our stuff and get on the road towards the next gig. And, you know, the club, you know, they were just like, we'll make it happen. Yeah, they weren't kidding around. They didn't have some electric digital keyboard in the back for any kind of like plan B. If they couldn't use the big real keys, they were out of there.
Those are some balls. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. That is impressive. So you were on tour with Ben.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a whole U.S. thing, or
no? It was just I think we did 2 or 3 weeks on like East Coast to Midwest, and then there was some other dates here and there.
Okay.
We did some New York shows, I think, when they got signed. We played their, like, signing party or record release party or something. They were tremendous, though. Honestly, when we toured with them, not that we were some gonzo, like, vocal harmony band, although we tried, you know, but after touring with them, it was kind of like, ooh, we have to get our game.
Yeah.
We have to notch up a bit, because they just had three tremendous vocalists, and they were all excellent musicians, and they put on a great, you know, very high energy for the most part show. And, you know, when you open for that and you see people kind of really kill it after you go on. And, you know, I felt we were a decent stage band, but touring with them, we really had to up our game. Touring in general with bigger acts. I mean, I think we played with Los Lobos, and we played with Bare Naked Ladies. And, you know, these are like tried and true,
right,
seasoned musicians, and you know, you really either have to bring it or not, you know. or stop.
Yes.
You
know? I played a show in outside of the Balcony Ballroom, something ballroom that was outside of Cleveland.
Okay.
And I played with the Asylum Street Spankers. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Asylum Street Spankers deal was they didn't plug in.
Yeah, right.
And this was a TLA size joint. This is, you know, 1,000 people, something like that, standing up. And they weren't going to plug in. And so they did my sound check, me and my guitar. And I was like, well, fuck me. If they're not going to plug in, I can't plug in. You know, and I'm the opening act who nobody's supposed to listen to anyway. And I just felt like that was a tightrope. That was walking out without a net.
And you did it.
And I did it. I went out. I mean, we did sound check, and it was there in case it was my plan B. It was like, look, at least I can make a lot of noise in this microphone, but I'm going to try not to. And it worked great. It was, cool. I think the crowd respected my balls or just felt sorry for me and so shut up. Either way. But yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, we're gonna. So that. Well, then I met you. Then the next time I came in contact with you, you were producing Mia's record, Mia Johnson's record, Access. Now, you was it Mia and Hoagie at the time? Were you playing with her by then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, that's where I first met Mike. Was when I guess they were. Mia was sort of signed to MTG.
Yeah. Right.
And they brought Mike in to do Lap Steel and Dobro.
Lean in to talk.
And then produce. So it was, and I didn't know who Mike was, or even really the Low Road. That just wasn't my same circle. I'd heard of the Low Road because they were playing all the places like the Middle East and the TLA.
Right.
And things like that. But I knew their drummer, Mark Schreiber, just because he grew up in media, and I was playing in bands mostly out in the suburbs, so I knew Mark and some of the people that he played with at the time.
Okay.
Or before that, but yeah, that was our first.
This was at Sonic Studios, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Because Mia was like, she was an intern or something there, and so she got a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She had been an intern, and then I guess something happened, and she wasn't working there anymore. And I guess Dave felt bad, but dug her music and said, "Hey, let's get this thing going." And I think we were the first, maybe the only band that ever was on MTG, but we were the first one.
That was fun. There was a lot of buzz, and I remember I came in. I guess I probably came in. Did you record "Sick" there? Her song "Sick."
Yes.
Okay, so I probably came in for that chorus. I don't know if I played anything else on that record, but. But that's fun, and
yeah, the whole group, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah,
was fun session.
And if I remember correctly, we had a conversation. My takeaway from that is just like the picture of 20 years ago. What was that, 97 or something, 98,
yeah,
something
late
like
90s,
that.
90s, yeah,
90s, yeah. Was that you were just learning to play the dobro at that time, or had you already been playing it?
Yeah, I was new at it.
Okay,
I was new at it. You know, and there was a couple acts that I sort of learned on the gig. And one was Mia and John Treen, who I've been playing
right.
with forever, and Y'all from New York City.
Oh, I didn't know you played with Y'all, yeah. One of my first showcases at the Philadelphia Music Conference was at La Taza out in Manayunk with Y'all. Because, you know, we're both, like, you know, what do you do with acts that people call novelty acts or whatever? And I was just like, really? You put me with dudes in dresses. That's not really what I was going for. But they were sweethearts, and they were fun.
Yeah. Fantastic singers.
Too, yes. You know? Yeah. That's right. Mia used to cover a Y'all song about cottonwood trees or something. It's all coming back
to me. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so, now, where did you grew up? When did you pick up a guitar?
Early on. You know, I was 14 or 15.
Okay.
You
know, to get chicks?
Of course.
Yeah. You know.
And,
how'd it work out?
But I was playing Philly clubs, you know, pretty early on. While I was still in high school, I remember playing this place, Bacchanal.
Yeah!
That was probably the first place I ever played in Philly. Although I do remember kind of sitting in with these guys I knew, one of whom was my guitar teacher at the time. I sat in at Khyber Pass, like pre-cool Khyber Pass, you know.
Okay.
And at Dobbs as well. But I remember I had a sort of like a new wave band in high school. My parents weren't so pleased that I was playing gigs on school nights, you know, when I was in 11th grade or whatever. And my mom said, you know, there's drugs in those clubs. And I was like, come on, there's not, you know. I'll never see them. And I remember dumping my stuff at Bacchanal for like the first gig, you know, first Wednesday night or something for this band. And I walked in with my gear, put it down, opened the men's room door, and there was a guy with a needle in his arm knotted out on the toilet. I thought, my mom, you know?
Maybe he was diabetic.
My mom's right, I guess. There are drugs in these
places. Did you go home, right home, and tell her? Mom, yeah, right. You'll never guess. You were right.
I took the needle out of his arm.
Here, you want it?
Here it is.
Here it is. Waste not, want not.
Souvenir, my first.
So what we're going to do now, so we're going to cut, it's song time.
Okay.
Even though we haven't gotten to the point of you actually learning, finding, discovering the chaturangi,
mm-hmm.
But we're just going to play a song. So play whatever you want to play.
Okay. Maybe we'll do one Hoagie and I have put together. This is called Easy Come. Gotta get the rent done, make it and everything I spend.
That's an original. Mm-hmm. Like with this instrument, how much you plan like originals and covers? Like, are you playing traditional or?
Definitely not doing too much traditional stuff, but I kind of started doing a lot of covers on this just to kind of use them as a tool to get my hands on it.
You know?
That was an original, and there's a couple more, but I hadn't done a huge amount of writing on it, but I got pretty into taking sort of strange covers and almost Indianizing them a little bit and sticking them on this. You know, for some reason, new wave covers sounded really good on this.
Like what new wave covers?
I was doing Pretty in Pink.
Oh, really?
I was doing Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Oh, wow.
And what else? There was some other stuff here and there. But, you know, I was just kind of looking for things that would sit on this guitar in a neat way. And
Wave of Mutilation.
Wave of Mutilation. Not new wave, but Pixies and odd tunes and everything.
So this thing, I'm looking at it now. So it looks like a guitar, like an archtop guitar that you got. Actually, it's your gig. Describe this thing to people who are not looking at it.
Yeah, it looks like an archtop F-hole type body, and the neck though, and it has six strings that I'm barring, set in open D,
like a standard dobro.
Usually dobro's in G, but, you know, that's the idea. So six string that I'm sliding on with the bar. And then on the treble side of those strings, I have these two drone notes. And that type of high drone note is, very idiomatic for Indian music. They're called the chikari strings.
Okay.
And I have another set of chikari on the bass side. And using those, you can get some neat.
And are those D's?
Those are all D's.
Okay.
They're all unison. And then the neck is really wide to accommodate the chikari and also to accommodate these sympathetic strings, of which there are 12. And those are called the tarif strings.
Okay.
And you can play them like a harp, like I just did, or they pick up the right, if you're, you know, tuned correctly, they will kind of echo and respond when you play the right note. Like if I'm playing, this is set up all in D, and if I play a C or like a flat 7.
Oh, yeah.
You'll hear that sympathetic.
Oh, very cool.
You know, especially on the root. So that while you're playing, the guitar is responding and almost giving you a bit of accompaniment while you're. It's very, you know, very typical for Indian instruments. The sitar has these tarif strings too, and a sarod, which is kind of a guitar-like Indian instrument, has the high chikari.
Okay.
And this instrument is called a chaturangi, and it was developed and invented by my teacher Debashish Bhattacharya. And in Hindi means many-limbed. So the idea is you're taking, you know, one thing from this instrument and another thing from this instrument and kind of grafting them onto a...
Yeah, we call that Frankenstein over here.
Exactly.
That's Frankenstein. So you've got two bridges. You've got the bridge for the regular strings, and then the sympathetic strings have their own bridge?
Yeah, it's like a buzz bridge.
Okay. Okay, so that's more of like a sitar-style bridge?
Yeah.
Okay. There was a guy, I should know his name, but I forget, but he used to sit in with WNOC sometimes, and he had a sitar guitar.
Oh, cool.
And he'd come up and rock it out. And it looked just like a Strat, except it had a different bridge.
Like one of those Jerry Jones sitars?
Yeah.
Those are cool.
Yeah. So that was pretty... Oh, I didn't realize you. This is a custom-made deal. You've got a slow-mo inlay on the neck of your guitar.
I do.
So was this guitar luthiered by your teacher, or is that not his thing?
His company.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. He's got, it's really neat. I went to Calcutta to study with him for about 5 weeks, and he took me, this guitar needed a little bit of adjustment, so we went over to one of the, you know, one family does the inlays, mm-hmm. one family does, you know, the bridge work.
Oh, okay.
Another family will do this and that, and took me over to the guy who was more of the luthier, the guitar guy, because, you know, just there were some buzzes and little things. And
yeah, so if you take this to a guy, to an American luthier, can it...
They can figure something out.
Okay.
It's fairly, you know, there's not a lot of moving parts. If you see right here, there's a string post that holds this note. And this pit post right here, lower down, used to look like that, but I snapped it off with the bar.
Oh.
And then Chris DePinto, we couldn't really figure out what to do, and we wound up screwing this screw in.
Okay.
And cut the head off of the screw and made a new...
Oh.
And, you know, the Indian people were horrified.
Right.
When they saw that, but it works for me, and I can never snap it off because it's this steel
right.
screw there. But
oh, nice.
Did the trick.
So was this, what, did this start off life as a regular guitar that was aftermarket? No, it started off with, okay.
Just this, yeah.
All right.
You know, it's got a square neck, and it's really just made for this. There's a couple other models he makes that are even more ornate that have these amazing scroll.
Oh, the curls at the, yeah.
Yeah, they're really cool.
La-di-da-di.
It's essentially the same string placement. There's another guy in India named Vishwan Mohan Bhatt. And he has a version of this called the Mohan Veena. And it's very similar. The idea, the main difference is the tarot strings run underneath the six playing strings. So you can't strum them as easily. Although I've seen guys figure out a way. They put their picks in between the strings.
Oh, widen it, yeah.
And then the high chakaris are on the low side.
Oh,
and at the time, because I have a like sort of student model Mohan Veena, I learned on that. And at the time, I couldn't imagine why they did that. Because this made more sense, the guitar I'm playing now.
Right. But
since then, I've seen people do amazing things on the other guitar. So it's really just, you know, there's incredible musicians in India that work at these things for decades. So they figure out a way around the obstacles. But this made more sense to have the treble side chakari, because then you can kind of, you know...
Nice.
It's a little more difficult to do that with your thumb on the high ones down there.
So how often do you change this, all the strings?
As little as possible.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, I really should change them more, but it's... You know, at least
yeah.
It's like an hour and a half, couple hours out of my life to change the whole thing.
You need a guitar tech.
Yeah.
So you, if I remember the story correctly, you're in Boston when you saw a video of this dude playing this thing.
That's correct. Yeah, I was on tour and I went to a music store in Cambridge, and I was already playing lap steel and dobro at this point, and very into it.
Who were you out with?
Marat.
Okay.
So I was up there and I had some time, and I went to college in Boston. So
where'd you go?
I went to BU.
Okay.
And I knew about this music store, so it was one of my favorite places. So I took the tea up there and I was kind of wandering around, and they had this big, you know, big shelf full of, music videos, instructional videos. And I saw this one, you know, the spine of it said Hindustani slide guitar. What is this? And I pulled it down, and there was this, you know, Indian gentleman cross-legged with this unbelievable looking instrument. And, you know, I kind of asked the people at the store. They had no idea what it was, and I just kind of picked it up and watched it as soon as I could. And it was really, you know, one of the greatest slide players I'd ever seen in my life, and one of the coolest instruments. And actually, that was my teacher. That was Debashish Bhattacharya.
Okay, so you see that, and then how does that turn into... what's the path from seeing that to going to India for 5 weeks to be with him?
Well, I searched around and basically came to the conclusion that there was no one either playing or teaching this instrument. You know, I didn't have any hopes that there would be anyone in Philly, but I figured there had to be someone. You know, New York has a thriving...
You would think, right.
Indian music community, and there was no one. And I called this guy... he's since passed away, but is Bob Brosman, a musicologist,
okay.
And incredible slide player, both lap and bottleneck style, and we had some communication, and he said, well, there's really no one doing it in the States, especially on the East Coast, but Debashish is going to be in town in like a month. He's going to be in New York teaching a class in about a month. And I said, all right, you know, I'll do that.
No, wait, had you bought one of these yet?
Let me try to think. Yes, I had bought a Mohan Vina. I found a Mohan Vina on the internet.
Okay.
I bought it from, like, sight unseen from Calcutta.
Oh, wow.
And,
yeah. Sending your money off into a void and hoping.
Leap of faith.
Yeah.
I was living above this, still there, this Northern Liberties, like, provision food, you know, and I remember when this truck showed up and they basically unloaded this kind of coffin-looking thing. And all the guys down below and loading the trucks, you know, they used to give me a bunch of hassle about everything, but they saw this coffin with Indian language on the outside. They thought it was Al-Qaeda or something.
Ali!
And so I was working with that. I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't have it for that long. And then I got the chance to study with Debashish, first time I met him, in New York. And I remember I was staying with my friend Dave and Marat. I was staying with him in Brooklyn. And every day I would take the train. And there really was no other student. There was one other guy, a German guy, who was a bottleneck player. So really the class was one-on-one.
Oh, wow.
Essentially for about a week, so I got really into it after that. And, you know, he said, you know, his first two things were, you know, you have to get one of my guitars instead of this, and you have to come to Calcutta to study with me. And it took me a while. I studied with him several other times in the States. He would have these seminars or week-long teaching things while he was touring. And I did a few of those, and I started, you know, I think I even did some Skype videos, and I started to try to immerse myself in Indian music, which is really, it's very hard to get the Indian thing down with in a short period of time, because it's ancient music, and it's, you know, often played by, you know, monster musicians, you know, and it's not something that you can just kind of grab, but, you know, I did my best to try to pick up little things. And finally, I guess it's almost 3 years ago now, my friend Edan Cohen.
Yes, of course. I know Edan.
Did a video for me, and we did a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
And I raised the money to both study in Calcutta for 5 weeks and then cut a record over there with my teacher and
right.
some of his family members. I finished it up here. But yeah, it was a great experience. Amazing. I mean, really, over there, once you're studying over there, not a lot of fooling around. It's 8 to 10 hour practice days.
The way I imagined it, you know, whatever I read about it was like, you sort of, I just imagined you waking up in a hut on the floor, pulling on like some linen pants and eating some lentils and then just sitting Indian style and playing that friggin' thing all day.
Pretty much. Something like that. Yeah, we'd do meditation in the morning for a little while and then we would do an hour lesson in the morning. And he would give me these impossible exercises. And then he would get up all of a sudden and say, it is time for chai. And, and you know, I would call him Guruji. That's what you call your teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Guruji and several of his friends and I would make our way across this incredibly busy street, you know,
right.
around lunchtime. There's no lights there. And they would just kind of walk right into traffic. And I would be terrified.
Yeah.
And kind of hanging onto the hem of his garment, and cursing. And they thought I was hysterical. And, you know, we'd make our way across the street, and we'd have this really delicious chai tea, and have a cigarette, and make our way back. That was the other frightening thing. We'd have to make our way back. And then he would take lunch or take other students. And I would kind of go up to my little room and practice these lessons with a metronome for a good 4 or 5 hours. And then he would return often at night, and we would do another lesson basically to see if I picked up on what he was talking about. And he would give me more stuff, and then he would leave, go home to his family, and then I would practice another 3 or 4 hours into the night. And then at one point I would run down the street to a takeout place, which made fantastic Indian food.
Is it like Indian food, like when I go out to Indian? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he had actually accompanied me down there early on and talked to the chef, and he said, you know, this guy's going to be coming down. Don't make it too spicy.
He's up on the round eyes.
Yeah, and, you know, don't no fresh chilies, you know.
That's so funny.
And then every time subsequent to that, I would walk down the street, and they would see me coming, and they'd be like, Guitarwala! Guitarwala!
Oh, that's nice! Just
basically calling me Guitar Chump.
But, oh. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I liked it at the time.
Yeah.
I was like, it's not really complimentary, is it, Guruji? And he's like, well, they like you, you know. And then a few days into it, you know, I think I had this idea that, like, all right, you know, I'm not going to drink alcohol because it just doesn't seem to be the thing. And that lasted maybe 2 days. So I started asking these young kids that worked at the school, and I said, yeah, where do you get beer around here? And at first they were like, oh, we'll get you some. Okay. So they came back with these, you know, big bottles of Foster's Ale. And that was fine. And then the next time I was like, you know, Shubid, can you get me some more beer? And they were kind of like, oh, okay. And then the third night, they were like, well, why don't we show you where to get the beer? And they walked me down, and it's, you know, Hindu society, not big on alcohol. And they're especially not big on walking, like, around with, you know, not necessarily open alcohol containers, because you certainly wouldn't do that in many cultures, but they don't even want to see you sort of carrying
it. Oh, okay.
Right? And there's not a store, or at least where I was, there wasn't a store. It was almost like a ticket kiosk, and you would wait in line with all these other Indian men, and it was, you know, and they would sort of jostle you and, like, cut in front of you, and, you know, and, like, it was kind of competitive alcohol buying. You know? And you finally get to the front of the line, and they would be like, you know, what do you want? You know, and there was really no time to, like, kind of look around, because you had to kind of look underneath this kiosk and be like, well, what kind of beer do you have? And they're like, what do you want?
And I finally, for something crisp and hoppy.
Exactly, you know. Do you have any wheat beer?
Is there a lambic back there?
Exactly. So I just said, two Fosters. Because I knew that they had that.
That's funny.
Because the other kids had gotten it. So the rest of the time there, I just drank these big, you know, quart bottles of Fosters.
Were there Western-style toilets?
Yes.
Attaboy. How bad a trip could it
not
be?
Everywhere.
Not
everywhere. But in my modest little apartment above the school.
Nice.
You know, it was fine. They didn't have showers, and that's typical for Calcutta. They do more of like a bucket bath type thing.
Okay.
Which I didn't really care about so much, but I will tell you that when I got home after 5 weeks, that 45-minute hot shower.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like Folk Fest Monday.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's my favorite shower of the year.
I was like, Jesus.
Cleanse.
Yeah.
Why don't you play us something else? Now, first of all, this is made to be Western tuned.
Well, yeah, I mean, people ask me a lot. They say, well, isn't it a totally different scale? And the best way to explain it is, you know, Indian music, the biggest difference between Indian, I would say, Hindustani music, Hindustani classical, and Western music is there's not a lot of harmony going on.
Okay.
And it's also in a static key. Like, I tune this to D, and everything's in D. Although, say, in a Western sense, it's all different modes of D.
Gotcha.
That's kind of the best way to explain it. like, you know, our major scale is an Indian rag. And, you know, one rag that I love to play is this, is called... Vairav, spelled B-H-A-I-R-A-V.
Sure.
Vairav, yeah. And that, you know, in a musical in a music theory way, it's a major scale with a flat 2, so it's a D, E flat, F sharp major 3rd, natural 4, natural 5, natural 6, flat 7, and then up to your root.
Right.
And then they would call it, they don't go by that notation system. They have a notation system that's instead of our do re mi fa sol la ti do, they have sa re ga ma pa da ni sa.
Okay.
So that took a little bit to kind of get that translation down. And then if, you know, if this is sa, and this is what we would call a flat 2, they would call that a como re. And then this is ga, major 3rd. So there's like that kind of
but it's parallel. Still a 7-note scale?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The thing that people think is the different scale is usually how Indian musicians will approach their notes and throw on those, what we call ornamentation, you know, where mm-hmm. you get that kind of...
Right.
And that's really just the approach to the notes. There's no different... There's no different scale to it, but it's, you know, it's a highly inscribed, or I should say highly, you know, prescribed way of, like, if you're playing this rag, you approach the ga note this way and never from the, you know, you're never from the ascending, it's always from the descending.
Oh, okay.
A lot of rules like that, and then when you're playing a certain rag...
That's why I got into music, because of the awesome rules.
Yeah, exactly. And then, like, if you're playing a certain rag, there, you know, there's parts to it. There's a very slow part called an alap, which is, you know, that kind of dreamy section without the rhythm.
Okay, yeah.
And then the rhythm is added, you know, typically by tabla. And then it culminates in the big, you know, super fast, you know, jing, 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 you know, the really right. kind of explosion of speed. And that's called jala. And,
Now, all of my Indian musical knowledge comes from George Harrison and Ravi Shankar.
Yeah.
Like everybody else in America.
Me too.
So, and I think I remember reading one time that all Indian music is sort of improvised. It's all, it's not like there's like a classical piece where there's pages of sheet music.
There's definitely not sheet music. I would say in all rags, there are certain phrases and, certain elements that you have to play a certain way that designate that rag.
Okay.
And especially if you're at a concert with people that are very in the know, they can kind of call the rag within a few notes or so.
And then, is it like a jazz band where everybody gets a solo?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes, at times.
Okay.
Although if, you know, the times I've seen my Guruji play, it's just been chaturangi, tabla, and that the instrument that gives the real
what is that?
Tambura. And sometimes they use an electronic tambura.
Okay.
For performance sake, and sometimes the it'll often be a woman doing the tambura because they're the singer.
Oh, okay.
So there isn't a lot of trade off there. That's like, you know, just this guy. It's often, you know, I would say more often than not, there's one instrumental maestro that's going to be doing it, you know.
Okay.
And not the trade-off thing, but, and rags can take, you know, rag can be an hour.
Oh, really?
An hour and a half.
Settle in.
Exactly.
Okay, so this isn't punk rock.
It's just, you go through the whole experience. You go from that quiet alap. And you travel with the musicians.
Okay.
And all of a sudden there's a pulse. Doom, 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 doom. You know, and that is very, you know, not improvised at all. It's, you know, we're doing this rag and that has this beat. And,
okay.
You know, very... there are 4-4 rhythms. There's one that's called Tintal that has 16 beats. And you know, beginning Indian students often from West... You know, Westerners will often start in Tintal because our ears read the 4-4 much easier.
Okay.
Yeah, 16, it's like four bars of four.
Yeah, right.
As opposed to trying to count, you know.
No.
Yeah. it's really, and a lot of the times it's very fast. So, I mean, this is music that a lot of these musicians have grown up since day one.
Right.
So, you know, to try to journey into it as like a newcomer, you know, as a someone who's been playing like new wave music, you know, and folk rock and stuff like that. It's a hard journey in.
But are there many white people trying to do this?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Some quite successfully, of course.
Okay.
Probably someone like John McLaughlin would probably be one of the better known. But yeah, there's guys that. But you really got to put years into it to get any kind of like handle, any kind of understanding on it.
Okay.
There's a Canadian guy that plays a Mohan Veena that maybe people that have frequented folk festivals have seen. His name's Harry Manx.
Okay.
And he studied for a long time with that other guy, Vishwan Bhatt. But, you know, he's quite good. I mean, he sort of does what I do, and he kind of utilizes the unique aspects of the instrument, and he plays folk music and bluesy stuff and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
He'll do some, you know, rock type stuff, but despite his knowledge and his experience over in India studying with Bhatt, you know, and I've never seen him do like a raga performance. You know?
Right.
He's a folk musician, but he has that extra little bit of, you know, northern Indian knowledge in his hands. And
well, how about you? When you play a show with this, you don't just play one raga all night. You I mean, we're Westerners. We need our songs broken.
Yeah,
up.
Yeah. We do tunes. For a while, I was playing with one of those electronic tempura things.
Okay.
So the entire set would have a backing of like, but then I stopped because I didn't think people knew when to clap. You know? So I would finish a song and it would be, and people would kind of.
Yeah, I'm in it for the applause here.
I am done.
You may clap now.
You may clap now. But so I stopped doing that. It actually has been a better reception. But yeah, so I mean, I'm like, you know, folk, rock, Western musician. I like playing sets. But, you know, we have a couple, two or three moments in the set where Hoagie and I can kind of get off on the drone.
All right.
You know.
Well, do you have a cover you could play for us? One of those new wave ones?
Sure.
I would love to hear that. So, in the words of George Harrison, please listen to the Indian music.
Yeah, right. They're just tuning. Yeah, why don't we do this Pixies tune? It's called Wave of Mutilation. Thank you. Greatest mermaids rode the El Niño. Walked on sand with the crustacean.
Is that on? You put out the Chaturangi record.
I did.
When you came. Now you said you recorded a lot of it in India.
I did.
Is that song on it?
No. It was all no covers on that.
Okay.
Most of the record is instrumental, although there were two tracks that I worked on in Philly, and I sort of put some of them together, and it was. The only two tracks that actually didn't have any of the Indian musicians on it was Susan Rossetti was singing, and a friend from Fishtown, Jason Rinker, was playing tabla.
Okay.
And Alfred James, who co-produced the record with me and helped me finish it up, played strings and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And those were the only two that, and they were originals, they were my lyrics, and everything else on the record was instrumental, although I did have some great Indian vocalists, but they sang in that improv.
Okay, now are those words or is it like scat?
It's like scat, yeah. It's like, what is it called when you sing, you know, the do re mi stuff?
Solfege.
Solfege, yeah, it's similar to solfege. They sing sa, you know, sa re ga ma.
Okay.
It's a horrible imitation of Indian.
That's all right.
Yeah, but,
if I was sitting out in the crowd and I spoke their language, I would be so upset.
Exactly.
Really? Do re mi, you don't write, you have anything to say? So, Hoagie, you're playing the dumbek. Is that an Indian instrument? I just think of it as a Hoagie instrument.
No.
Yeah, come on up in here.
It's actually a Middle Eastern instrument, and these goblet-shaped drums are all throughout the Tigris-Euphrates area. And the main differences are what the what they're made out of. The different cultures have different ones. Like the Armenians have nickel mines, so they make theirs out of nickel, and they raise sheep and goats, so they have goat skin on them.
Okay.
This is actually an Egyptian style one, where the original ones were made out of clay from the Nile.
Okay.
And then they would put a sturgeon skin or a skate skin.
Oh, wow.
On them. And amazingly, the modern ones are made out of cast aluminum. And they have a plastic skin, but it has the same timbre as a original Egyptian.
So how many, what's the plural of dumbek? Dumbek or dumbeks?
Dumbeks.
Okay. So how many dumbeks do you own, dumbek?
I'll take that as a compliment.
Yes.
I'm trying to think. I think really the difference is size-wise. I have this, the largest one, and this one seems to have that nice lower fundamental that works well with what we're doing here. But I have a smaller one, the tiger-striped one, which I used to have all the time, which I went up to back in those days when I first started learning. You had to go to New York in Brooklyn. And you had to go to the spice importers and find them. And they would have, you know, on the middle shelf would be Turkish taffy, on the upper shelf would be dumbeks that they would bring back. And so anyway, the This one, I actually got this one pretty recently from Sean. I can't remember Sean's last name. The red-haired fellow plays percussion. We did a thing with his...
Oh, yeah.
But anyways, I was at a jam, and he was sitting on this Dumbek, big-sized one, and I'm like, man, you never played the big one. And he's like, I don't really like it. I just like sitting on it. It's not really. I said, how much do I have to give you right now
to stand up?
Because I don't have... Because I really wanted a big one, and they're kind of hard to get.
Okay.
So we made a deal. We went to the cash machine, and I went home with it. So... But I have, I think, three different,
okay.
Three different sizes, and then I have an Armenian one, and but they're, it seems they're not really traditionally used with Indian music, but out of all the different ones that I have, this one seemed like it made sense, and the best thing about all of it is Mike and I have now, we could go play gigs, and it's one trip to the car.
Oh, tell me about it. I know about that. And sometimes I have to beat a hasty retreat in Alabama and such. Yeah,
right. And that's the... And that was the goal.
Well, you know, too, you're a road dog. You were on the road with Mia for 5-10 years or whatever that was.
Right, and before that.
Yeah.
But no.
Well, you guys would do, I mean, when you and Mia were road dogs, you know, she would do clearly between like 100 and 200 dates a year, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're driving around that station wagon.
We were actually out more than we were in for a couple years.
Yeah. Now, you are, if I remember this story correctly, I'm not even sure this is going to pan out. You were in a couple of bands. Two of my favorite bands you were in that I've never seen, I just heard you tell the stories, is Wheez Dink and Ointment.
Yes.
And I think, I remember this story you told me at Fergie's a million years ago, that there was a guy in one of those bands that just played the rain stick.
Yes.
Good gig.
No, actually, no, you know what, he wasn't in the, he wasn't in Ointment, but he was in, actually, the Wasted Potatoes.
Oh, okay.
Mikey Potatoes group, and we played with them a lot, but it was always funny because he would be setting up the, you know, like he'd come in with the rain stick, and he had, literally, they would set two mics up. To mic him as he's playing the rain stick, and you know, it was always like kind of. And finally, Bruce, the lead singer from Ointment and Wheez Dink, went to Mike and he said, "Mikey Potato," and said, "Dude, what, you know, like, what's the deal?" And he goes, "Oh, we don't even turn it up in the PA. We just mic him." And he's like, "Well, why do you do that?" And he goes, "Well, he's the weed guy."
I love that story. That's an important part of every band.
Right. Certainly, the Wasted Potatoes.
I remember George at the Tin Angel, the old sound guy, used to tell all those stories. You know, he was the road manager for Wendy O. Williams back in the day.
Oh man!
And wow. And when you hear some of his stories, are crazy. Like he would like whenever he got into a new town, the first thing he had to do was go to the thrift store and buy all of the televisions so she could smash them, and then he had to go to some parking lot and meet the drug guy.
Nice. And then he had to keep the electrical tape.
Yeah.
Too, right?
Yep. Eventually, one of those tours, he told me, they actually went to a warehouse in New York and bought 300 televisions because it was less, it was more efficient, and carried a whole truck full of TVs rather than buying them in every new town.
Hey, can we borrow that TV for this?
Right. Sure, I'll need it back. Oh, you'll get it back.
Well, Hoagie and I are playing these days with No Good Sister.
Okay.
It's funny because we're both in it. He's doing percussion and I'm doing slide, but it's a whole, you know.
Right.
You know, he's bringing a drum kit. And I'm bringing my lap steel and amp and pedal board and everything, so it's more than one trip to the car. But
yeah, that
now, did
enjoyable
you,
though.
Did you ever play pedal steel?
I do play some pedal steel.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't play it live so much, but when I'm doing session work and people specifically ask for pedal steel, you know, I can usually.
Oh, see, I'd love to get you. I didn't know that. I get you and Tom Hampton in a room and have a pedal steel off between the two
good.
Guys.
He's very good at pedal steel. You know, I consider myself more of a lap steel dobro player.
Okay.
But
then, do you play this with any other bands, or is this just?
No. I've put it on some recordings of other people.
Right.
And they have to have something in D, and the you know the tonality has to work, but.
You should record Blood on the Tracks. That whole album's in D.
Is that true?
I think everything but one song, I think, on that album is in D.
Right?
Yeah.
We did do... We're working with a singer. His name's Lance Davis these days. And the one tune that we've gotten really pretty good at doing is It's All Over Now, Baby Blue.
Oh, yeah.
In this situation. Is pretty
cool. Yeah. I imagine. That seems like it would naturally land. Mm-hmm.
Actually, Mike played this with one other band that we're in... called Better Than Recess.
Yeah.
kids band, and Kathy is playing some of the stuff on.
Oh, cool.
Kids Corner.
Oh, nice.
So
wait. So how many bands are you in right now, Hoagie? Other than all of them, so you're in the Roddenberrys.
Roddenberrys, Better Than Recess, No Good Sisters, really. Seeming to take off, so that's really...
Yeah, I've just been reading about them. I haven't been to a show.
Oh, yeah, you got to come out. It's really fun.
Okay. Great singer.
Phil D'Agostino plays bass.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a nice three-piece band unit, and then the three girls doing the harmonies up front is really cool.
Nice.
It's fun. Boy, all kinds of stuff. Hired Guns, blues band, Fergie's every first Friday.
Are you playing Dumbeck in that?
Drum set.
Oh, full kit, okay.
I'm actually, yeah, now that I have a place that I can play drum set... A lot. I find that I'm playing more drums at these days.
And do you still have that cocktail kit?
I do.
Okay, because that's what you played with Butch at the Troc, I think.
Yes.
With Butch Ross.
Yes.
And he set up a little three. You played that cocktail kit, which I think was cool. You play standing up.
Well, it was great, except for that it turns out that to play the bass drum, you're pretty much hopping up and down on your one leg.
Oh.
And that lasted for a
while. Over that shit.
For Butch. And then, but I think, I was just thinking about Butch when we were talking about the Chaturangi, because I think the band was called the F-Holes.
The F-Holes, that's right.
Wasn't that what it was
called? He had a bunch of different names. I think he settled on the F-Holes because... although one night after practice, I remember he came home and he's like, I think I know the name of my band, Butch Ross and the fucking Morons. It's like, I like it. It's got a ring.
How did you think of that one?
Exactly.
And if you can piss off Butch Ross, that's a special kind of annoying.
I just had a nice talk with Butch. He called, like old school, called on the phone.
Oh, wow.
And so I answered because I figured he must need my help. I mean, he must be stuck. But he was in a Walmart parking lot after a gig, you know, sleeping through the night. And so I think he's just like, I got nothing to do. I'll call Adam. So we chatted just like the old days.
That is old time.
It was nice. It was nice. We pissed and moaned.
Oh, man.
So let's talk a little bit, and then you'll do another song, and we'll wrap up. But let's talk, we'll jump back. The slow-mo situation and persona. Like, how did you come across? So you start playing slide guitar, mm-hmm. and you turn out you really love it.
Mm-hmm.
And then how did that evolve into what slow-mo became?
Well, went through a lot of changes. As much as I really tried to steep myself in like bluegrass dobro and like, you know, folk and kind of country forms to learn the instrument, which I do think is important to start. I loved electronic music and new wave and, you know, techno and stuff like that. And I was always trying to figure out a way to try to combine them, you know, my songwriting to basically use the dobro as a songwriting tool, but to add beats instead of, you know,
right,
sort of train beat on.
And this was where, like, 2003 or
earlier?
Okay,
it was earlier. It was still like late 90s, early 2000s.
So that's like the vanguard of adding beats. Now everybody's doing that shit, but
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, and it's funny. So I did some demos doing that with this guy named John Wicks, who worked with like King Britt and everything. And I did this recording. It was kind of a joke, kind of a novelty recording called Country Girl. And
it's a classic.
And at the time, I sampled Carter Family.
Oh, okay.
And then I think the final version had had Jenny Benford sort of singing an imitation of that. But that made its way to this guy, Tom Rothrock, who was a producer in Los Angeles, who was doing some work. He had, you know, he was famous for Beck. He did the Loser record.
Okay.
Malgold. And he was working with Elliot Smith and a lot of cool people. And he was putting this label together that was kind of, you know, trying to do sort of rootsy stuff with an underpinning of beats and everything. And we were working on the record, and at the same time he was doing a little production work for the Moby record, the
Play
record, which was sort of along a similar, you know, like, what at one point I wanted to sort of do a record that sampled a lot of like old timey music and stuck it to beats.
Yeah.
And Moby was working on this like gospel kind of version of that ad, you know. I didn't really follow through with it all the way, although Country Girl made it on there. But I got to do this record in LA with Tom and another guy named Beale Dabbs, who did amazing programming and stuff like that. And around that time I thought, like, well, I want to do some sort of persona. I had this nickname since high school, Slow-Mo.
Why'd they call you that in high school?
This guy named Bobby Jones used to make fun of me because I was such a shitty basketball player. You know? He was, check out Slow-Mo, you know? Motherfucker, you're moving backwards, you know? But, and that popped up with Y'all.
Okay.
That I mentioned before, because everyone had to be like the mandolin player was Cousin Rob, and the bass player was Uncle Al. And they were like, what do you want to do, Mike? And did you ever have any nicknames? I was like, oh, I had this shitty nickname, Slow-Mo, in high school. And they were like, you're Slow-Mo. So I figured I might as well own it. And then I saw this picture of this vaudeville famous slide player. He played a lot of stuff. His name is... Holy shit. His name is slipping my name. I'll think of it in a second. Okay. But he was a famous vaudeville musician. And he did all these incredible sort of novelty things on lap steel and ukulele and mandolin and everything. And he was posing in this white suit with these Hawaiian musicians behind him. And it was a super cool picture. And I kind of grabbed that from him. And I started to do this white suit thing. And then for a while I was playing with a turntable guy, and we had the whole set.
Yeah, right.
We had the whole set on turntable.
DJ Vincenzo.
DJ Vincenzo. And I did that for almost a year. And then I started just kind of like wanting to play with live musicians again. And brought Hoagie back into the mix and a rhythm section. And then I was trying to figure out what I was going to do for my next record. And I had this groove and a chorus. And Edan and I were working on this track, and I was like, it sounds like a hip-hop tune, like you would want like a rapper to put something on it. And he said, well, I know this rapper, Mike Recca, and he was doing some other project. And he goes, you want me to ask him? And I was like, yeah, okay, ask him. And, you know, Recca put this his rhyme on this tune, My Buzz Comes Back.
Yeah.
And that kind of changed my whole direction at that point. I was like, I want the whole record to sort of sound like this.
Cool. You know?
And it didn't, but... We did use Mike Recca on a bunch of the tracks, and then we added Sue and Steph from Stargazer Lily, and we added Daryl Hirsch on keys. This took a while. I mean, it was like a long path, but the band we ended up with, which was Mark Schreiber and Steve Demarest on drums and bass, and Hoagie on percussion, and Sue and Steph on backup vocals, and Recca became like the front man.
Yeah.
And Daryl Hirsch on keys and me on steel, and it just worked. It worked really well for a long time.
That was like a fun band, yeah.
Yeah, from like 2005, 2006.
You guys would play a lot. You would play. You were always playing New Year's Eve, I think, at the downstairs at the World Cafe, right?
Yeah, upstairs. Yeah,
upstairs. Okay.
Yeah. And then the best gig for us, we played this great Blue Heron Festival.
Yeah,
saw one of those. And
you put me on your list and said you want to go out to Hell Festivals. I live for that shit. So yeah. I drove my RV up, and I still remember. I pulled in and I said I'm on Slow-Mo's list, and you know, there's so many people in their band, they just assume, dirty guy, he must be in the band in the back somewhere. And it's like, yeah. Oh, we're so happy you're here. Let me show you. And I got this VIP treatment all weekend. I was like, well, yeah, don't tell them I'm not actually in the band.
Yeah. It was really fun.
You guys are rock stars.
Up there.
And Dawn of the Buffalo is the other band.
They are the sort of the kings of that festival. That whole Western New York State region, they're like a big deal. And
that's a fun fest.
Yeah. So, you know, we did that for a bunch of years. And then, you know... The band kind of broke apart for various reasons.
Shit happens.
And it was right around the time I was going to India. So
okay,
when I came back and that band wasn't, you know, wasn't operating.
How many white suits do you own?
Just one.
Just the one. A white suit. That is. I bet Steve Martin had a bunch back in the day.
He did.
And where did you get it, Mike?
I got it at Suit Corner. Second in market.
Oh, that's awesome. The only thing more authentic would have you been at Crass Brothers, 937 Star South Street, Store of the Stars.
Store of
the Stars.
I remember they were like, what is this for? Because you know, I was like, it's for my music group. And the guy was like, you guys play gospel? And at the time, I just was like, yeah.
So you all dressed in white? No, just me. Yeah, that was that.
Really
that was
into Colonel Sanders.
The Colonel Sanders experience.
Either that or Tom Wolfe.
And then you toured with Moran. That's where you got to hang out with Steve Earle.
I toured a lot with Moran. Yeah, we toured almost a year as his opening act.
Yeah.
They were on his label.
Yes. And he produced their record, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I don't think he didn't produce it, but I mean, it was his label.
Right.
The executive producer, I guess. But, and then I spent a lot of time playing with the late Jason Molina.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. How'd you meet him?
Through Edon, actually.
Oh, okay.
And it was funny. I just did a interview with XPN because Secretly Canadian is re-releasing the record that Edon produced, and it was my first. It was done like right around here, at his Soundgun.
Oh, okay.
He had met Jason and some other guys, and we recorded this record very quickly called "Didn't It Rain," and that was really the first one of the first records that people really started to notice of Molina. It was under the Songs Ohio
right
name. And then soon after that, he had me in Chicago, and we recorded this one record called Magnolia Electric Company with Steve Albini. And then I started touring with him for a long time.
Okay. Was that rough? I mean, I imagine he wasn't the easiest guy to tour with.
In the beginning, it was cool, but he had some major alcohol problems. And unfortunately, that really killed him.
Yeah.
You know? I hate saying it in such a sort of flat tone like that, but it was real tragic because he was very amazing singer, incredible songwriter. He had a huge fan base all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the time, you know, I didn't really know who he was when I first did Didn't It Rain. I'd sort of heard of Songs Ohio just because it was a kind of a strange name. And then we toured under that name, and then kind of like unbeknownst to us, you know, he once we were doing sound check and he was like, by the way, we're called Magnolia Electric Company now.
Okay. But I just got t-shirts.
and then we did a lot of European stuff. He had a really great thing going on.
Oh, here. Yeah. Now, what was it like when I was a kid? My dream was to work with Steve Albini because I liked that he wouldn't call himself a producer; he called himself a recorder. Mm-hmm. I heard a Robbie Foulkes album that he did, and I was just like, "This is the guy I want to record my record." Mm-hmm. What was it like working with him?
I liked it. You know, super efficient. The stuff always sounded great. He was very quiet, very dry. You know, but very like, you know, totally on it. My favorite story. One is more funny than the other. We were cutting. I don't know if someone was doing overdubs or there was a break. I seem to remember he was like, we're going to have to take 20 because there's something wacky with the board that we're going to have to, you know, sub out or something like that. The compressor was flipping out. So we all kind of walk up and we were in the upstairs. If you ever go to Electrical Audio, there's an upstairs studio and a downstairs. In the upstairs, the master control is kind of lofted above everything.
Okay.
And it's kind of small. So we're all up there and, you know, sitting there quietly while he was doing his repairs or whatever. And there wasn't a lot of room, and there was this acoustic bass sitting on a stand. And the keyboard player walks in. He's just kind of standing there. There really wasn't a place for him to sit. And, you know, everyone's quiet, reading or looking at their phones or whatever. And he picks up the acoustic bass and straps it on. And, like, no one was even looking at him. And all of a sudden you heard this, dum, dum, da, dum, 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 dum. And you could just sort of see Albini kind of like his back kind of curl up. And he barely even turned around. He just kind of just turned his head very slightly in that direction. And he just went, please don't do that. It was like dumb, dumb, dumb. And he took the acoustic bass and put it off, and then he kind of like looked around the room for a place to sit down. There was no place, and he just walked out of the door, walked down the steps alone, and the rest of the band and I kind of looked at each other like, ooh.
Note to self.
It was the keyboard player too, I have to, you know.
Fair enough.
It's not his fault.
Understood.
But, yeah, he was, you know, very, he was dry and efficient, but, you know, my experiences were generally good, you know.
So I've been talking here with Mike Brenner and Hoagie Wing. This will, like I said, this is going to go up early February. You got anything in February you want to tell people about?
Sure, we've got a lot of stuff. I mean, Hoagie and I are playing in February with No Good Sister. I think that there's, I wish I had the calendar in front of me. So look for No Good Sister. Definitely check out their website.
Sellersville, in the month?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, cool. The Sellersville Theater.
I think
nice.
It's February 22nd.
Okay.
Full band.
We're opening for Eileen Jewell in Sellersville.
Okay.
And John Train is every Friday at Fergie's from 6 to 8.
And my pal Bill Ferguson's in that band.
Playing Mando.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our dogs are friends.
Oh, cool.
Nice. Yeah.
You guys are going around here, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's a bunch of other things. You know, we're busy guys. So.
Okay, I'll put links. The name of the Chaturangi record is
Tripti.
And where can they get that?
You can get that on iTunes, CD Baby.
Okay.
Look for Mike Slomo Brenner Tripti. And
spell Tripti.
T-R-I-P-T-I. It means satisfied in Hindi, but it was also the name of the takeout restaurant that I met.
Oh, that's nice. So you're going to play us out there, Guitarwala.
We're going to do one more.
Yeah.
It's another original. We're going to finish it up with a bit of a jam.
All right. My guests have been Mike Brenner, Hoagie Wing, Slomo, Tripti, all the Chaturangi and all this stuff. Thank you so much for coming in. This was a blast.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. Thank Take you us out. That was friggin' awesome. That was very, very cool. And we are clear.